So hey there, good afternoon. I think people are, hi, hello. I think people are still trickling in, but I'm just gonna go ahead and get started because I wanna make really good use of this session. Thank you all for coming. I'm amazed by the turnout because I know there are a bunch of other really cool things going on, so thank you for coming. My name's Marsha Hoffman. I'm a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you. Thank you. How many of you know what EFF is? Okay, all right. So for those who don't know, we are a nonprofit based in San Francisco, and we work to protect digital civil liberties. And the talk that I'm giving here today is one that I'm really excited about because it's a topic I've been thinking about a lot for the past couple of years, and I love to geek out about it. And in the past couple of years when I've come to DEF CON, people really seem interested in this topic. And I speak at a lot of information security conferences and hacker cons, and sometimes I talk about this a little bit as part of my presentations, but I've never done one that just focuses on this, and I'm really excited to get to, you know, completely geek out on it with all of you guys, so thanks for coming. So I'm going to talk about the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and the way that that applies to government attempts to force people to turn over passwords or encryption passphrases or actually decrypt information. So I'm going to hit three main things today. The first is I'm going to give just a general overview of the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, you know, where it comes from, what the test is, how that works, so that we are all on the same page before we start talking about the stuff that we're a little bit more interested in maybe, which is how it applies to government attempts to force people to decrypt information or turn over passphrases. And finally, I'm going to talk about ways that a person could increase the likelihood of having a valid Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination if it ever came down to facing an attempt by the government to force you to decrypt data. So, of course, the standard legal disclaimer, this is not legal advice, this is just information. If you have a question that's particular to your own circumstance, you should talk to a lawyer about that. If you don't have a lawyer that you like to talk to at this point or that you feel comfortable talking to, you should feel free to call us. And if we can help you, we will. And if we can't, we will make every effort to refer you. Okay, so first of all, we're going to start with the basics. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution says a whole bunch of things, but one of them is no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. So in the United States, the only person who can force you to reveal information to the government is a judge. And a judge can only do that if you don't have a valid constitutional right against self-incrimination, all right? So here's the basic rule. The government can't compel a witness to make a self-incriminating testimonial communication. Okay, that's pretty basic, right? Pretty straightforward. We're going to come back to it in a minute and really break it down. But first, let's talk about the policy behind that. Why do we have this privilege? What do you all think? Why do we have it? Forced confessions, that's exactly right. This comes from, it has its roots in the English common law. And for, you know, many hundreds of years now, I think it's been pretty standard that, you know, society does not want a situation where people are put in this position where they have to be forced to give information against themselves or, you know, risk punishment by the government. The Supreme Court has called this the cruel trilemma. This is what we're trying to avoid, is putting a person in a situation where they have to choose between incriminating themselves, lying to the government about the circumstances, or risk being held in contempt of court, which means that you may have to spend time in jail. So, you know, we basically decided that it's unfair and untenable to ever put a person in that kind of a circumstance where basically the only choice they have is to give information to the government that would tend to incriminate them, or they could lie, or they could go to jail. So we try to avoid those circumstances. That's the purpose of the privilege. Okay, so let's go back to the rule. Here's the rule I gave you before. Now let's break it down. This rule has three basic parts. The first is compulsion. The second is self-incrimination, and the third is testimonial communication. Okay, so first let's talk about what it is to compel a witness to do something. So this is actually, I think, the most straightforward of the elements. Compulsion means a government attempt to force someone to communicate something. And that can be pretty informal, like as in like a police questioning. You have a right to remain silent there. But it can also be something more formal, like a court officially ordering you to do something. That would also be compulsion, because you're required to comply with that. What we're going to find in the encryption cases is that what we're often dealing with is a grand jury subpoena. So let me say a few words about what a grand jury is. I think we often think of juries as this group of people who are chosen from the public, who decide innocent or guilt, right? A grand jury is a little bit different. It is, again, actually a group of people just chosen from the public, but the function of a grand jury is not to determine innocence or guilt, but rather to determine whether there is enough evidence that someone should be indicted for a felony, okay? So a prosecutor basically kind of runs the show and gives evidence to the grand jury, and the grand jury decides at the end of the day whether or not there's enough evidence that we should indict somebody for having committed a crime. And the grand jury is empowered to issue subpoenas to bring evidence in for them to see. So they might issue a subpoena to have somebody come in and testify, or they might issue a subpoena to have somebody turn over items or records. So those things are all fair game. And as we will see, that's the deal. That has been the deal for the most part when we're talking about the encryption cases. So just keep that in mind. Okay, so compulsion, that's pretty simple. We got it. Okay, what is self-incrimination? So Merriam-Webster defines self-incrimination as incrimination of oneself. Okay, very helpful. Thank you, Merriam-Webster. Specifically, the giving of testimony which will likely subject one to criminal prosecution. Now, this is really important. You know, I think a lot of people think that a person would tend to invoke the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination or the right to remain silent because they don't want to admit guilt. Right? And so basically, if you're invoking that right, it must mean you're guilty. Well, self-incrimination does not mean that you're saying you're guilty. What it means is that you are giving something up that might subject you to criminal prosecution. And think about it. I mean, sometimes people are indicted for crimes and they're ultimately found guilty. But sometimes people are indicted for crimes and they're ultimately found innocent. And so that's a very important thing to remember. You have this right if you're innocent, and you also have it if you're not innocent. Basically, what we're saying here is that you have a right not to give information to the government that might result in you being subjected to criminal charges. Okay? A few items about this. The privilege can protect any link in the chain of evidence needed to prosecute. So it's not even just smoking gun evidence. I mean, it could protect something that would ultimately lead to discovery of other evidence that might be incriminating. So it's kind of broad in that sense. It can only be invoked by the person who would be incriminated. So if you have information that's incriminating for a friend, you can't invoke the privilege against self-incrimination to avoid giving up information about your friend, okay? Similarly, corporations don't have a right to invoke the privilege. I mean, this is something that is very specific to an individual and, you know, that individual's own situation. Yep, I already got that. And as I mentioned before, I really want to emphasize this innocence part. And if you want to read more about this, I would encourage you to look up this article online by a lawyer named Oscar Michelin, which is a really simple, easy read. And he talks about the history of the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and the fact that it protects innocent people. One of the examples he uses that I thought was really interesting was this hypothetical. Like, imagine you're at a party and somebody is assaulted at that party. And you didn't do it, but a friend of yours did. And the police come knocking and they say, hey, you know, we'd like to ask you a few questions about the situation last night. So what Oscar Michelin says about that is that he would advise a client in a situation like that to invoke the right to not answer. Because basically, if you talk to the police and you say, yeah, I was at that party last night, and you say, yeah, I know there was an assault, you've basically already admitted a lot of the information that might be needed for them to charge you as a suspect, even if you didn't do it. And, you know, all they need at that point is for somebody to say, correctly or wrongly, that, you know, they think maybe you did it. And, you know, at that point, you may be falsely charged. And, you know, he says, why would you, if you don't have to help them at all, why would you? Why would you give them anything that they could use against you? Because they can't use your silence against you, right? So I thought that that was a really interesting and good example. And, you know, I this innocence thing, I know I keep harping on this, but, you know, it's because I think a lot of people have a misconception of this privilege. And, you know, the Supreme Court, in a case called Ohio versus Reiner in 2001, you know, made this really clear. In that case, the Ohio Supreme Court decided that a person who maintains innocence cannot also invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. And the Ohio and the U.S. Supreme Court reversed that and said, nope, that's not true at all. Because, you know, what we really want to do with this privilege is protect people who may be caught in, you know, ensnared in ambiguous circumstances. And, you know, actually haven't done anything wrong, but, you know, it might look like they might have. Okay, so that's incrimination. Now, the third one is the third element is testimonial communication. The government can't compel a witness to make a self-incriminating testimonial communication. This is the really sticky wicket, and this is the issue that's been, I think, most at issue in the encryption cases. So, a testimonial communication is one that reveals the contents of your mind. It's something that reveals your knowledge. A testimonial communication is not something that already exists, okay? So if you happen to have an item in your possession and you know, the police try to compel you to turn that over, you know, if it's just some item, that's not a testimonial communication, right? Basically, they have to be forcing you to say something you know. And the Supreme Court has made a comparison that I think is useful when we think about this. The Supreme Court said, you know, imagine the police trying to force you to reveal the combination to a combination lock versus, you know, them asking you to surrender a key in your possession. Obviously, the combination would be in your mind. The key is not in your mind. And so the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination would protect the first, but not the second, okay? And, you know, for similar reason, the privilege doesn't protect you from having to turn over things like handwriting samples, voice recordings, blood samples, fingerprints. These are things, they are just facts about you. Everybody has these things. If they try to force you to turn this kind of thing over, it generally would not implicate the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. But there's a twist that gets a little bit tricky. So the Supreme Court has said that the privilege against self-incrimination can apply to an act of production if it has testimonial aspects to it. So there can be circumstances where law enforcement or the government asks you to turn something over, and the fact that you turn it over can reveal something testimonial. So what would that be? The circumstances we're talking about are situations where producing something would tend to confirm the existence of it, or its authenticity, or that you had possession of it or control over it. And if that is something that would tend to incriminate you, then the act of turning it over might be protected by the Fifth Amendment. So I just told you, though, that, you know, turning over a key wouldn't implicate that, right? So how do we parse these things? The courts have talked about it in a way that I personally find instructive. They talk about a gap in knowledge. I mean, basically what we're trying to protect is something that you know that the police don't know, and they're trying to force you to tell them what that thing is, right? So there was a case called United States versus Pons in the D.C. Circuit that had an example that I thought was useful. Imagine two scenarios. One scenario is the police suspect that you might have shot somebody and murdered him. And imagine they go to a grand jury and ask the grand jury to force you to turn over the gun that you shot that guy with. All right? So turning that over would show that you know that you shot this guy with this particular gun and you had control over it, and here it is. That, I think, pretty clearly would be incriminating. Now, imagine a situation where they think that you shot this guy with this gun, and they go out and they do a little investigation, and they learn that you have a gun that you purchased and that it has a certain serial number, and then they come to you and say, please turn over the gun with the serial number. Now, if you turn over this gun, you're admitting that you have control over it, but they kind of already knew that because you bought it and they have evidence of that. And what you're admitting is that you have control over this gun with this serial number. It's not that you have control over the gun that you shot the guy with, right? And so you're admitting a lot less that they don't already know. So I think in the first example, there's a pretty big gap in knowledge between what you know and what the police know. And in the second example, it's a much smaller gap. And I think that in a situation like that, the privilege against self-incrimination would be less likely to apply. All right? Does this all make sense so far? I know it's a little bit tricky. It's there's a, like, an area in there that's a little swampy, and I sympathize. I feel that way too. So there are some limitations to the privilege. First of all, if law enforcement is able to get the same evidence in a different way other than forcing you to tell them, they can use it against you. Second, they can offer you immunity. And in certain circumstances, this can overcome the privilege. What they can say is, if you give us this information, we will not use it against you. And in that kind of a circumstance, basically, it's not incriminating anymore. So your privilege basically evaporates, right? The important thing about that is that the immunity has to be as broad as the privilege. There can't be some gap there. And that particular thing is something that's come into play in the encryption cases. We'll talk about that a bit. And, you know, again, if you cannot be incriminated, you have no privilege against self-incrimination. So that's the deal with immunity. Here's the other big thing, foregone conclusion. If the police already have a pretty good idea that evidence exists and that you have it and where to find it, then the privilege may not apply. And again, this goes back to the gap in knowledge, right? I mean, if they already know that you've got something and, you know, it's just a matter of turning it over, there's not a lot that you know that they don't. And at that point, it's just kind of a matter of surrendering evidence as opposed to, you know, them compelling you to tell them something testimonial. I think three circuit courts now, D.C., Ninth Circuit, and 11th Circuit, have said the government has to know about the existence and location of the evidence with reasonable particularity. I don't know what that is. Reasonable particularity. I think it's whatever the judge thinks it is. So here's something to keep in mind. People ask me sometimes, you know, well, wait a second. You know, if the government has, you know, proper legal process, and they've, you know, kind of checked all the boxes, and the guarantee against unreasonable search and seizure hasn't been violated, then aren't they just entitled to this stuff? I mean, like, how does that work? So something to keep in mind is that there's the Fourth Amendment, which protects against unreasonable search and seizure, and there's the Fifth Amendment, which protects against self-incrimination, and they are distinct and separate things. And it is possible for the government to do everything right over here, check all the boxes, and no Fourth Amendment violation is happening, but if they are forcing you to make a testimonial communication, that is something separate and distinct. And I think we'll see how that plays out a bit as we talk about the cases. So, the cases. I'm going to tell you about all the cases that have ever been done in this area. And there aren't that many. There are like five, so don't worry. It's not going to take all afternoon. But I think it's really interesting to go through and see exactly how this has come to pass, and we are where we are now. So the first one is a case called In Re Grand Jury Subpoena to Sebastian Boucher. And this is a case that came up several years ago. You'll see there are two citations there. There are two opinions in this case, the first in 2007, second in 2009. What happened here is there's a guy, Sebastian Boucher, wonderful name. He was coming from Canada into Vermont, crossing the border. I'm not going to get a whole lot into Fourth Amendment stuff here, but I will tell you that your Fourth Amendment rights at the border are not very strong. In fact, they're quite weak. And so border agents can search pretty much anything that you bring across the border. And he drove across the border, and in his car he had with him a laptop. And as far as I can understand from the opinions, I think the laptop was probably on. And he was stopped, and the border agents searched his stuff, including his laptop. And there was a border agent who spotted something on there that made him concerned that there could be child porn on this laptop. And so he calls in another border agent who's you know, kind of more forensically skilled. And this guy questions Mr. Boucher a little more seriously and looks around the laptop a bit more. And, you know, he actually asks, he says, "Hey, do you have any child porn on this laptop?" And Mr. Boucher says, "Well, you know, sometimes I download things from the internet, and, you know, I don't think it's child porn, but if I ever see that it is, then I just immediately delete it." And the border agent says, "Oh, okay, and where on this laptop do you keep those files that you download from the internet?" And the guy says, "Oh, well, it's here in this drive." And so he directs him to the drive, and the border agent looks around and spots things that he's pretty sure are child porn. So at that point, they arrest Mr. Boucher, and he is facing the possibility of charges for child porn. They shut down the laptop, and later they realize that the drive that he had directed them to is encrypted. And they say, well, that's a problem. And I think they try to brute force it, no luck. And so they go to the grand jury, and they say, we'd like you to force Mr. Boucher to give us the password to this drive. And a magistrate judge listened to that request. Now, a magistrate judge is, you know, kind of the, you know, all judges are highly esteemed and greatly respected people, but a magistrate judge is kind of the lowest level judge that there is. Again, they're all highly esteemed people. And now, the magistrate judge wrote what I think is a really great opinion. The magistrate judge said, "Well, listen, I think that if you force him to turn over this encryption passphrase, that is going to violate his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, because it is a it's compelled, obviously. It would be incriminating, obviously. I mean, they're looking at charging the guy with child porn. So the question is it a testimonial communication? And, you know, it's something that exists in his head. If you're making him give it up, it's pretty clear to us that that would be that would implicate the Fifth Amendment." The government said, "Well, we would be willing to give him immunity for the act of production." So think about that, the act of production. So basically, they couldn't use the fact that he turned over the password against him, but that would still make it so that they could use anything they learned as a result against him. Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you for that look. I know, right? I thought that too. Well, this puts people in an interesting situation, because, you know, as I mentioned before, in order for immunity to, you know, kind of wipe out the privilege, it has to be coextensive with the privilege. And if we go with this act of production theory, then what that means is that, okay, it can't be used against you that you type in a password or something, but then it's like, "Oh, look at all this evidence. I don't know where this came from. It's like the elves just delivered it onto my desk." And the Supreme Court has actually said this. They didn't use the elves thing. That's me. But they called it the manna from heaven theory. It's like the evidence just magically appears. It's like, oh, look at this evidence. I don't know how this got here. And then they can use it against you, right? And the Supreme Court, in a case called United States versus Hubble, said, no, you can't do that. I mean, if it's going to be extends, you know, if the immunity is going to be coextensive with your privilege against self-incrimination, then it has to extend not only to an act of production, but whatever they learn as a result of that. All right. But of course, you know, if the government can find that out in some other way, then, you know, that's fair game. So here, the magistrate judge, our good friend, the highly esteemed magistrate judge, said, you know, this act of production thing, I don't think that's going to cut it. I think that you would have to have a broader immunity than that. And he also said, you know, I also don't think it's a foregone conclusion that you are going to find, you know, what you're looking for on there. I mean, you might find that, but there are all kinds of other files, too, that you don't know anything about, and you don't know what they are. And, you know, I think that foregone conclusion certainly doesn't extend to that stuff. So I'm going to deny the government's request here. I'm going to quash the subpoena. I love that legal term, quash the subpoena. So the government was like, okay, well, what if we do something else here? What if instead of having him turn over the password, what we do is we just compel him to turn over a decrypted version of the data, all right? And you know, this is kind of like a funny, like, procedural thing. It's kind of framed as an appeal of the lower order, although they kind of, you know, change the request over the course of time. So, you know, at this point, we're dealing with a full-fledged district court judge who's hearing the appeal, but he's actually looking at a slightly different issue. It's no longer about, you know, whether this guy's going to turn over the password. It's about whether he's going to decrypt the information and then turn over a version, an unencrypted version of that information. So it's different. And this judge says, okay, well, I don't think that the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination goes to the underlying data because that was voluntarily prepared. It's already there. That data itself is not testimonial. However, the act of producing it is something different. He didn't go so far as to say that there was a valid Fifth Amendment right to, you know, not to produce this information. But what he said was, here I really do think that it was a foregone conclusion that they are going to find the evidence that they're seeking there because the guy showed them where it was. Like, they know exactly where it is. It is in the Z drive. You know, he saw the file names. Like, he knows. So, you know, back to our gap in knowledge. The gap in knowledge between what Mr. Boucher knows and what the government knows is basically nil. And so I'm going to order that Mr. Boucher produce what the government's asking for. Interestingly, he also ordered that they could not use the act of production or anything they learned as a result against him. So while they ultimately found that he did not have a valid privilege against self-incrimination that was strong enough to keep him from having to turn it over, he still ordered that you know, the government had to comply with a certain immunity that they hadn't even offered. Like, it was broader than they had offered. So I think that's a very strange twist in that case. And I you know, I speculate that maybe the judge, you know, had some concerns about the privilege, even though he found that ultimately it was a foregone conclusion that the government was going to find what it wanted there. So that's Boucher. So this case, I actually learned about not so long ago. This case was decided between Boucher number one and Boucher number two, the two decisions there. And it is unclear to me that the court even knew about Boucher at all when it made this decision. This is United States versus I can't even begin to. This is you see it. Gavagno, I'm going to get. I don't know. So in this case, things are a little bit difficult to understand because there's not a great deal of factual development in the opinion. And so, as far as I can tell, what happened here was there was a guy. He worked for a government agency. They issued him a government computer to do his work, and then they found child porn on it. And you know, he had, you know, signed an agreement saying that, you know, his computer usage was going to be monitored and X, Y, and Z. And so, so we're dealing with another child porn case, which, by the way, you'll see is a bit of a pattern. So here, there wasn't a grand jury subpoena involved, but what happened is after invoking his right to speak to an attorney, the police asked him for the password to his computer, and he gave it to them. And then later, he challenged that and said that it violated his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. In a very, very short little bit of analysis, it's literally like a paragraph, the court decided that it was a foregone conclusion that the government was going to find that stuff because the government independently knew that this guy was like the sole user of this computer. And, you know, the court didn't go much further in its analysis than that. You know, this is one of these cases where, you know, I think we see something important about the law, which is that often, when circumstances look really bad, like when we're dealing with a possible child porn case, I think judges often, they want to make sure that a bad person gets what's coming to them, right? And sometimes they don't think about these legal issues terribly hard or anything. They just, you know, it's kind of a barrier that's getting in the way of making sure that justice is done. And so bad, you know, what we say in law is bad facts make for bad law. This case, I don't think, is, you know, terribly damaging, you know, at very particular circumstances, very little analysis. But I think that it is interesting that the court found that the government just knew that this guy was the sole user of the computer. You know, I don't know about you, but, you know, I use my laptop, my work laptop, for all kinds of things, and, you know, I use it at home, and, you know, I imagine that that's actually kind of a hard thing to really know, that this guy is like the sole user of the computer. And so anyway, moving on. Next, United States versus Kirshner. So this one is a case out of Michigan. This is a year after the second opinion in Boucher. Grand jury subpoena situation. Any idea what the charges might have been? Child porn, anybody? The charges being investigated. So in this case, there was a grand jury subpoena, and they asked this guy to provide all passwords associated with his computer and all the files on it. And the court there, in a pretty decent opinion, I think, said, well, that would violate the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, because that's very testimonial. I mean, you're asking that he just provide all these passwords, and so that's a no-go. So, good opinion. So that's where the law was for a while. And then, just in the last few months, we learned about this case, United States versus Fricozu. Now, EFF did an amicus in this case. Situation here is, there was a woman, and she and her ex-husband were being investigated, and they were ultimately indicted on mortgage fraud type charges. So mortgage fraud, that's like, it's amazing. It's not child porn at all. They got a valid search warrant. The government got a valid search warrant to go to her house and seize computers there. And they seized 6 computers. 3 of those computers were laptops. One of them was encrypted. And the government was like, well, and they went to a court and asked that she be forced to basically help them execute that search warrant by providing her passwords or a decrypted version of the data in the alternative. So again, this is, I think, a really good point to think about, this Fourth Amendment versus Fifth Amendment, right? I mean, even if they did everything right and they got a warrant and they checked the boxes, no violation of the search and seizure protections of the Constitution, they still need her help, which implicates the Fifth Amendment, and it's different, right? So this woman, after the computers were seized, she had a conversation with her ex-husband, who was in prison on unrelated things. And when you talk to somebody in prison, the government, I think probably always, records that call. And so they had this conversation, and she mentioned that these computers had been seized and that there was an encrypted laptop and that she wasn't going to provide the password, and talked a bit about, in very vague terms, about what might have been on there and the government might be interested in that, blah, blah, blah. And then the government had that recording. And so what they argued was that, they said she didn't have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, but B, even if she did, it was a foregone conclusion that they were going to find, that it was hers, that the stuff on there, she had control over it, that, the stuff on there was, authentic, so that the foregone conclusion doctrine would apply, so that, she turns it over, no big deal, because they already know everything that she knows, right? And in this case, they offered her a limited immunity act of production that didn't go any farther. So again, that's our little elves coming and dropping the evidence on your desk. And so the court found that she had to turn over her passwords. And what happened there was the court was like, well, there could be a privilege here, but the problem is that the government knows that the government has a pretty good idea that it's hers. And one of the facts that the court identified for finding that was that there was an account login that they saw that actually had her name in it, right, on the computer. And they said, they seized it from her house, actually from her bedroom. There's a username that suggested that it's hers. And so, turning it over isn't going to give them anything that they don't already have already in terms of, trying to link her to the computer. So it's not going to harm her in the sense of, admitting that she had control over this stuff or anything like that, because they already know that. They already have independent evidence that suggests that. So I'm going to force her to disclose the password that they want. And not the password. We're going to force her to provide a decrypted version of the data. That was it. And so that raised a really interesting question, because, was she going to do it or was she not? And she had a little bit of time when she, could, think about it and decide. And her lawyer made some noises along the lines of, well, I'm not sure if she knows about it. I don't know if she knows the password. I don't know if she can do this, if she can decrypt this data. And, that raises a question that I think a lot of people always have about this is, what happens when, if you really didn't know and the government tried to, force you to turn it over and a judge said you had to and, you didn't know the password, if what would happen there? And, I've never seen a case where that actually now has happened. Furkozu ended in a slightly different way, and I'll tell you about that in a second. But, for whatever it's worth, my gut feeling about that is that would come down to what the judge thinks about your credibility, right? If he thinks that you honestly don't have it, you have nothing to turn over, you cannot decrypt the data, what are you going to do, right? But on the other hand, I think if the judge thinks that you're lying, then he would likely hold you in contempt. And, I think you might be on the hook for a much more serious problem, which is that, generally it's not a good idea to lie to a judge, because that can be perjury. And that's a whole other kettle of fish. So anyway, so she is in this conundrum, trying to figure out, I guess, whether she, can or wants to turn it over. And her co-defendant ex-husband went ahead and turned over the password. I actually kind of feel for the guy. Her lawyer said that he did it because he was concerned for their children. He didn't want her to go to jail. And so he turned it over. And so that kind of wiped out the whole thing. Because, of course, as we've discussed before, if the government has another way of getting it and they don't have to compel you to do anything, that's fair game, right? So that's for Kozu. So the most recent one is United States versus Doe. So in this case, the government was investigating a child porn, possible child porn situation. They are, trying to figure out, whether they want to bring charges in this case, and if so, against whom. And they identify an individual who they think is of interest. And they get permission from a court, search warrants, to go seize a number of computers. It was 2 laptops and 5 external drives from this individual. And it turns out that some portions of those drives were encrypted. And they got a grand jury subpoena, they being the government, got a grand jury subpoena ordering him to appear and type his password, type a password into a computer to decrypt these portions of these drives, which were, by the way, encrypted with TrueCrypt. And he, I know, again, this is a criminal suspect. He hadn't been indicted with anything. He did not have a lawyer, and he showed up, and he refused to do it. And then the prosecutor said that the prosecutor went to the court and said, we want you to order him to show cause why he won't do it. And the court said, tell us why you won't do it. And the guy said, well, because I have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege not to. And besides, I don't know. I don't know. I can't do it. I don't know the passwords. The court found him in contempt, and he went to jail. And, you know, I want to note again, he didn't even have a lawyer. All right? And I'm sorry if I'm getting, like, all mad, because it makes me angry, this situation. And this guy, while he was in jail, passed a note along to his sister, which she posted in a forum. And basically, this note was like, hey, I'm in jail because I didn't turn over I didn't decrypt my data. And that's how we heard about it. Actually, a number of people contacted us and said, did you hear about this? And we were like, whoa. And it was hard to get any information about it because it was a criminal investigation. There's nothing on a docket about that. And then eventually, after some months, he was assigned an attorney, a federal public defender, and that guy contacted us. And we were like, oh, you know this case. And so we did an amicus in his support in that case. It's actually under seal. We keep meaning to get it unsealed, and hopefully we'll do that so people who are interested can read it. But the 11th Circuit found in that case that he had a valid privilege against self-incrimination that he could exercise, the immunity, I forgot to mention, they offered him active production immunity. Again, the little elves dropping something on your desk. The court said that wasn't enough, that it had to be full use and derivative use immunity, and that, you know, the government had no sense what they were going to really find there. The fact that there appeared to be data encrypted didn't even necessarily indicate there was data, because the way that TrueCrypt works is blank space is filled with ciphertext, right? So, you know, for all the government knew based on, you know, looking at the ciphertext, there was basically, you know, they didn't have any evidence. There was a big gap in knowledge. All right, let's put it that way. So the guy was released from jail, and that is, I think, the strongest and most powerful precedent on this issue so far. So that's cool. Thank you. So I have 5 minutes and a bunch more slides, so I'm going to go fast. A few more things to think about, like thinking toward the future, okay? What about other forms of authentication, things that aren't in your mind? What about, like, biometric credentials or two-factor authentication? So we haven't seen a case with this yet, but as I mentioned before, things like fingerprints and blood samples, generally the courts find do not have this privilege. And so I think that this is a tougher call, all right? It is possible under certain circumstances, I think, that you could have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege in the act of production, but keep in mind that this stuff here is not as strongly protected under the Fifth Amendment, most likely. Okay, what about encrypted data stored with third parties? So, you know, Fourth Amendment stuff, I'm not going to get into what the government has to do in order to get data from a service provider. They have to jump through a bunch of hoops. We're just going to focus on Fifth Amendment stuff. So I think it is possible that a service provider could decrypt your data or turn over your passwords and passphrases in response to legal process or court order if they have the capability. And I'm not picking on Dropbox, but they're very clear about this in their privacy policy. They say, we may disclose to parties outside Dropbox files stored in your Dropbox when we have a good faith belief that disclosure is reasonably necessary to comply with a legal request. If we provide your Dropbox files to a law enforcement agency, we will remove Dropbox's encryption from the files. However, we will not be able to decrypt any files you encrypted prior to storing them on Dropbox. Okay, so lesson learned. Don't have a situation where a service provider has your encryption keys, all right? Keep control over them. Okay, what's the deal everywhere else? So one of our fantastic EFF interns, Whitney Merrill, helped me with this research, which I really, really appreciate. Answer is it's pretty complicated. These laws are different all over the world. Some countries require key disclosure or decryption under certain circumstances. Within that classification of laws, some of those laws only require assistance from people who don't have a non-disclosure right. So, laws are different in different countries, but some countries have, you know, varying levels of something like a right or a privilege against self-incrimination. And so I think that is the primary distinction, within the category here. Now, some countries restrict the use of crypto within the country. Some countries have import and export restrictions on crypto. That, of course, is beyond the scope of this presentation. But there's this super cool map that you should check out. There's this legal scholar in Holland named Bert Jaap Koops, who has this crypto law survey. I don't know if you can see this very clearly, but so the red countries have domestic controls on use of crypto within the country. The blue countries have laws that require compelled decryption in some circumstances. The yellow and orange countries have, you know, kind of special flavors of that. And then the green countries have no known domestic controls. And I think it's super interesting how, you know, for the most part, it's grouped, right? I mean, you can see that it's very kind of regional. Interestingly, Africa, which is, you know, pretty much white here, they have no data. We have no data available for those countries. We don't know what the law is there. So if you're interested in the international stuff, check that out. Takeaways. Okay. The courts have held that it's possible to have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege against compelled disclosure of encryption passphrases or forced decryption. But, of course, it can be overcome in certain circumstances, like, you know, when they already know what's on your laptop or what have you. But there are things that you can do to enhance the likelihood that you might have a privilege. Okay? Choose strong passphrases, and it's best if you don't have to write them down. XKCD, how to choose a strong password, high entropy and all that. Password managers, I think, can be decent for this because if you know the password that you need to get to your other passwords, you know, that's something, right? It's a level of protection. Understand that certain types of credentials might have weaker Fifth Amendment protections, potentially. Maintain control over your keys and your passwords and your passphrases if you can. I think Mr. Boucher taught us, don't consent to or assist in any search of your files, because at that point, maybe it's foregone conclusion. And when in doubt, talk to a lawyer. All right? Thank you very much, you guys. I really appreciate it.